and the Department for Education is eager to replenish its stock. However, Flynn questioned whether the US can compete with OPEC in a price war and said the Biden reverse releases were bringing a squirt gun to put out a forest fire. Instead, he argued the free market and drop in demand is driving the recent decrease in oil prices. And why should industry's risk be socialized, especially when its dizzying profits help spike costs across the economy, inflicting pain on many Americans? Amarnath claimed doing so will ultimately benefit the public. Oil companies operate in what he characterizes as feast or famine cycles, marked by price spikes and collapses. When demand dried up during the 2008 recession, oil prices plummeted from all-time highs of about $133 a barrel to about $39 a barrel within 6 months. Amid West Asia turmoil and high demand, prices and profits grew through to 2014. But oversupply stemming from the US fracking revolution and increased OPEC production cratered them last year. After a brief recovery, COVID dried up demand and, by May 2020, oil prices collapsed into the negative. By then, companies had stopped exploring for new oil, leading to the current scenario in which demand and prices are high, but industry isn't increasing production. Turnbull noted banks that lend to oil companies have also lost money, so the government's partial floor price makes borrowing to cover the cost of new drilling easier. Amarnath said while 2008 and 2021-2022 were banner years for oil companies, there were a lot of bad years in between. He added, a number of major producers have effectively committed to not growing production and have said, we played this game too many times and our shareholders are too unhappy with us. Amarnath said, by setting a partial floor on prices, the administration's plan provides short-term stability through to 2024 and 2025 and will encourage new drilling. Though the Biden administration hasn't said what it will attempt to steer prices, observers say the ideal zone is between $70 and $100 a barrel, which could keep gas prices in the $3 to $4 a gallon range.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Rising costs in the U.S. have pushed Americans to the edge with soaring inflation and the government's inability to control the matter so far. Inflation in the U.S. has shattered all previous records in March and currently is hovering around 8.5%. With inflation hitting the highest rate since 1981, the rising cost of living has been squeezing households and putting pressure on policymakers to bring the issue under control. And now government officials have warned Americans that the worst is yet to come. The U.S. Federal Reserve's Chair Jerome Powell has warned of pain ahead for Americans in the battle against inflation. While pledging that the Fed will continue to act forcefully, he also warned that the U.S. job market will suffer in order to get prices down. He says the damage which will be dealt to the job market is an unfortunate cost of reducing inflation.
Well, monetary policy only has an effect of 6 to 9 months of a lag. He just started raising interest rates here significantly in the last 2 months. So it won't really start to have an impact on inflation here until fourth quarter, maybe, of this year. But it won't have that much impact, I don't believe. I don't believe that it's going to be very quickly reducing inflation from its current 8.5% down to the Federal Reserve's 2% target here within the next 6 months or even within the next 18 months. I don't think they're going to get it down to that. They're going to continue raising rates because the only real solution, even if it is a limited solution, is monetary policy interest rates. They aren't going to hike taxes to slow down the economy. Government spending is just shifting from social program spending to military spending and subsidies to corporations kind of spending. So fiscal policy isn't going to do anything. Monetary policy can only have a limited effect, but the Fed is going to push that solution as high and as long as it can to shake out whatever it can shake out in terms of inflation.
According to recent surveys, Americans believe inflation tops the list of problems the country is faced with. This has led to U.S. President Joe Biden's approval ratings plunging heavily, leaving the Republicans criticizing him over the issue. Nevertheless, the U.S. government seems to be more concerned about the conflict in Ukraine, where it has so far given away billions of dollars in weaponry. The price of gasoline in the U.S. has witnessed a record high, averaging more than $5 a gallon in recent weeks for the first time ever. Meanwhile, Biden's attempts of lowering prices, which have included draconian measures like releasing crucial gasoline emergency reserves and even begging the Saudis to increase their oil output, have so far proven to be ineffective. While Americans are suffering and getting crushed under the dire economic situation, the government headed by Biden has just pledged another $3 billion U.S. dollars in aid to Ukraine. Washington has already assisted Ukraine with more than $18 billion in military aid since the launch of the Russian special military operation. But why is it that while Biden has described combating inflation as his top domestic priority, the government can't think about its own citizens before spending money on these wars?
This is only the beginning of subsidizing Ukraine. It's like $60 to $70 billion already in just 6 months. Ukraine says it needs $7 billion a month just to keep its economy going. Treasury Secretary Yellen of the U.S. Said we're going to give you $4 billion. So the U.S. is propping up Ukraine economically and militarily and so forth. It's becoming, an economic satrapy of the United States. The U.S. is deeply penetrated economically in Ukraine. That's why it won't leave. And that's why, it provoked this situation with this war purposely. The U.S. Really sees it's got, it's 2 feet on the ground there in Ukraine. And its whole policy with regard to this war is just to continue with the war in a low grade, well, maybe not so even low grade, for as long as necessary.
All in all, the U.S. is reeling from its support of Ukraine in its conflict with Russia, while its economy is seeing a severe downfall. But this is only the latest in a catalog of problems, from increasing social divisions and political paralysis to an inability to recover from the economic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. And all this has led many to believe the U.S. is losing its power and standing in the world. The Palestinian Authority has renewed its push for full membership at the United Nations amid long-time acts of obstructionism and opposition by the United States. Any application for full membership at the UN would need approval from the Security Council, and that means the US participation. The Palestinian ambassador to the UN says he has been consulting with Security Council members over a possible full membership bid over the past weeks. But the US, a full-fledged supporter of the occupying Israeli regime and a UNSC member with a veto power, on the other hand, has once again reiterated its opposition to the move, saying it will block it. The US's reason behind rejection of the Palestinians' push for membership: it should only occur after the resolution of an agreement for a two-state solution. But the real reason behind the US's opposition to Palestine's move is that membership would mean full international recognition of Palestine as an independent country on the international stage. In other words, Palestinian statehood, and that would be consequential for Israel. Yet the US is at much fault for Palestinian situation, as is Israel. PA's ambassador to the UN has said, given that the peace process has been frozen for 8 years and that there is no initiative on the table, the issue of full UN membership should move forward.
Well, the United States provides $3.8 billion of military aid to the Israeli occupation every year on an annual basis. So what this means is that the United States is a full partner in all of the war crimes and crimes against humanity perpetrated by the Israeli regime. And this has been the case for decades upon decades. I mean, throughout the nearly 75 years of Nakba against the Palestinian people, the United States and other imperialist powers like Britain and France and Germany have been full partners with the occupation and these crimes against the Palestinian people. I mean, Palestinians have the right not only to full representation and recognition at the United Nations, but more importantly and fundamentally for the liberation of all of Palestine. And, you know, really what we need to be talking about is kicking Israel, kicking the Zionist regime out of the United Nations, not just recognizing Palestine.
In 2012, Palestine was granted non-member status, but this was done in the General Assembly, where no member has veto power. And now this has raised the assumption that Palestine may be following the same path to gain full membership. The Palestinian Authority's push comes just several weeks ahead of the UN General Assembly, where world leaders are set to convene in New York for their annual summit. Israel says any vote for the Palestinian cause and against its illegal actions impedes negotiations and progress in a chance for better lives for Israelis and Palestinians. The regime claims that a vote against it would obstruct peace, but these claims come in contrast to what is happening on the ground. Just looking at the past few weeks, Israel has ramped up its attacks on Palestinian towns and cities, leaving dozens dead and many others injured. Palestine, on the other hand, has been adamant that its full membership was essential if there was to be any chance of leading a dormant peace process. But why is Israel so persistent against Palestine gaining full UN membership?
Well, what we've been seeing throughout the years is that in the United Nations, the United States has consistently used its veto power in the Security Council in order to prevent the Israeli regime from being held accountable for its crimes, just as it has used that same power in the Security Council to attempt to impose its will upon other countries and to protect its own war crimes and crimes against humanity from being held up to any meaningful form of accountability. And so, of course, the Israeli occupation wants to completely erase Palestinian identity and existence, and that's been the case for the past 75 years. But what's really important is actually to fight back against and boycott and isolate, including in the United Nations, the occupation regime. Because simply saying that, Palestine is recognized in the United Nations is not doing enough to actually liberate Palestinians from the grasp of colonialism, occupation, and apartheid.
The last round of Israeli-Palestinian talks collapsed in 2014. Among the major sticking points in those negotiations was Israel's continued settlement expansion activities in the occupied lands. Iran's proposal for the issue of Palestine told a mass referendum, something Iran's leader has said would be a logical solution to the conflict.
It has been a rocky economic road that the Brits are traveling on, which continues to chip away at their income. Some were questioning how they would manage their expenses in the UK these days. Why, with an unprecedented inflation and a cost of living crisis, now their nightmare has gotten worse. An 80% increase in electric and gas bills have been announced, one that is coming before the winter season.
It is a major problem because what is happening, of course, is, first of all, real incomes are falling because people are not getting wage settlements in line with inflation, but below inflation. Then tax burden has increased, you know, to record levels as well. The government has been raising taxes to pay for the furlough scheme and all the money that they splurged.
To be exact, an 80% increase would mean that it would average about £3,600, or about $4,200 per year from October. And this is terrible news, especially for the poor and the ones at the bottom half of the social strata. The UK was suffering already from high energy prices, in particular heating bills, even before the Ukraine crisis began. So bad was the situation that fuel poverty, as it was called, was leading to deaths for people who could not afford to heat their homes. These are the stats that are truly shocking, that one would not expect from a European country. For example, this article in 2020 pointed out to how thousands of people in the UK died from the cold, and that fuel poverty was to blame. On average, there were 32,000 more deaths between December and March than the rest of the year. Many perished because of the refusal of a society with abundant wealth and resources to provide for its most vulnerable citizens. An average of 9,700 deaths each year were believed to be caused by living in a cold house.
We know we need to do more because actually the most vulnerable households have no cushion, have nothing available to them. So what I'm looking at is how I can target that help for those people, not just to January.
The unprecedented hike for energy prices in the UK will surely affect the UK's economy. One obvious outcome of this price increase is that it will chip away at people's spending power and income. This is while people's income has not kept pace with the inflation rate. Increases have been minimal or not at all. This may explain why there have been so many strikes and protests recently in different sectors in the UK. The latest, the postal workers' strike. 115,000 workers across 1,500 locations. Criminal barristers and mass rail strikes have also plagued the UK, as the country is battling a historic cost of living crisis. The outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson has sure left an economic mess for the next administration to deal with. But was it all his fault? The UK did not have a sound economy even before the pandemic started. Among the group of G7 economies, the UK has suffered the highest inflation rate than any other G7 country, as price rises have reached a 40-year record, with inflation recorded at 10.1% in the year for the month of July. That is the highest since the year 1982. And with the Ukraine crisis showing no signs of ending, the future looks bleak for the country, especially since the new administration will not officially begin work until October. And Boris Johnson's view on this, the new administration will clearly have to help people with energy bills.
That I know that even if things can sometimes seem dark now.
The Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran has staged a massive drill which features scores of cutting-edge reconnaissance and combat drone. The drill covers the strategic waters of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, as well as the country's central regions. Over 150 new advanced drones are flown in the drill. The Army's 1401 Joint Drone Exercise involves units from the Ground Force, Navy, Air Force and Air Defense Force. The units have already carried out their intelligence gathering and patrol missions. They include homegrown Yasir, Sadiq, Yazdan and Ababil 3 tactical surveillance unmanned aerial vehicles. Pelican vertical takeoff and landing naval drone, as well as Muhajir 6, were also flown from different bases. Muhajir 6 is an ISTAR drone, which means the drone can operate intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition, and reconnaissance missions. It can significantly boost Iran's capability in confronting threats. The drill features the Army's latest achievements in drone engineering and production. Due to the expansion of unmanned aerial capabilities, execution of various and numerous drone missions, and the need to coordinate such flights, the Army has set up a command and control network for the drone operations. The exercise exhibits only a small fraction of the achievements made by the Islamic Republic of Iran's army.
Iran has for some time now shown that it is a world leader in drone technology, both in terms of indigenous capabilities developed by Iranian industries and the reverse engineering that Iran has done off of some of the United States frontline drones, which Iran has acquired one way or another. But it's not just the technology, it's how it's adapted for the modern battlefield.
This is the first time that a joint drone exercise is conducted at the level of the four forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army and the country's joint air defense base. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headways in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient in the armed sphere.
And so it's drones and the technology and the tactics are adapted to these realities. And so, it's one thing, though, to have theoretical knowledge. It's another to have practical. And these exercises, I think, take Iran's drones and allows the Iranian military to practice using these drones in realistic scenarios that will make these drones more effective if Iran is ever called upon to use them in a conflict.
Iran says it has become an exporter of military drones in the world and that the country holds the upper hand in aerospace. Back in July, when U.S. President Joe Biden was visiting the West Asia region, Iran's army unveiled its first division of ships and submarines capable of carrying armed drones.
It's the height of hypocrisy, hubris-based hypocrisy, for the United States, Israel, or any Western nation that incorporates drone technology into their operations to call out Iran for developing their own drone capability and employing these drones in support of Iranian backed actions in the region. The United States invented the armed drone, and the United States has used armed drones extensively throughout its involvement in the Middle East and Central Asia and elsewhere.
Earlier this year, Iran's new combat drone called Gaza successfully passed flight tests and became fully operational. The vehicle has a 21-meter wingspan and a 3,100-kilogram takeoff mass with the capability of carrying a payload of 500 kilograms. And before that, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unveiled one of its new kamikaze drones, dubbed Mehraj 504, which is specialized in attacking enemies' defense systems. The Islamic Republic's military doctrine holds that the country's armed capability solely serves defensive purposes and poses no threat to other states.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
People who become infected with the Omicron variant are less likely to spread the virus to others if they have been vaccinated or have had a prior SARS-CoV-2 infection, according to a study in U.S. prisons. And people who have had a prior infection and been vaccinated are even less likely to pass on the virus, although the benefit of vaccines in reducing infectiousness seems to wane over time, says Ruby Prosser Scully, writer, in an article published under the heading COVID vaccines / risk of spreading Omicron, and so does prior infection. Stay tuned for more. People who become infected with the Omicron variant are less likely to spread the virus to others if they have been vaccinated or have had a prior SARS-CoV-2 infection, according to a study in the U.S. prisons. And people who have had a prior infection and been vaccinated are even less likely to pass on the virus, although the benefit of vaccines in reducing infectiousness seems to wane over time. The findings are good news, says Megan Stein, a virologist at the University of Sydney, Australia. They show that the more exposure people have to the virus, whether through vaccines, boosters, or infections, the higher the wall of immunity, she says. If we can keep high levels of booster vaccinations up, then we can decrease how infectious people are when they are sick, she says. The study was posted as a preprint on the MedRevix this month and has not been peer-reviewed. Nathan Lowe, an infectious disease researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, and colleagues analyzed data on more than 22,000 confirmed cases of SARS-CoV-2 infection across California's 35 adult prisons over a five-month period, starting at the end of 2021, when the first wave of Omicron began ripping through the United States. The wave started with BA1 subvariant, but by the end of April, BA2 had overtaken it and was the most common cause of COVID-19 in the country. Previous studies have suggested that vaccinated people are less likely to spread the virus if they were subsequently infected with Delta. But Lowe's study is one of the first to consider whether vaccines and prior infection reduce infectiousness with Omicron. The team found that among individuals with COVID-19, those who received at least one vaccine shot were 24% less likely to infect close contacts, in this case, cellmates, compared with unvaccinated prisoners. People who had been infected before were 21% less likely to infect others compared with prisoners with no prior infection, and those who had been both vaccinated and previously infected were 41% less likely to pass on the virus compared with unvaccinated individuals without a previous infection. Lowe says he is surprised at the dose-response relationships. Each vaccine dose a person has had reduced the risk of passing on the virus by a further 12% on average. How recently people had been vaccinated was also important. For every 5 weeks that passed since a person's last vaccine dose, the risk of transmitting the infection to a close contact increased by 6%. Although vaccination and prior infection helped to reduce Omicron's infectiousness, neither were enough to halt the number of new infections among prisoners. 4 times out of 5, the people who spread on the virus to others had been vaccinated or previously infected. Prisoners were isolated after they tested positive, but close contacts had usually been exposed for around 2 days before the COVID
positive individual was isolated, says Low. Unvaccinated people had a 36% chance of transmitting the virus to close contacts, but prisoners who were vaccinated and had a prior infection still had a 20% risk of spreading the infection. Stein says the findings accord with what researchers know about the virus so far. But as new variants evolve, it is possible the way they cause infections could change. If some variants are able to replicate faster, for example, then they might be more infectious because you're getting higher viral loads faster in the nasal cavity, and therefore you would think what would equate to more shedding, says Stein. Previous studies on transmissibility have often focused on households where transmission is less likely to occur than in cramped prison cells. And almost all of those studies were done before Omicron, often in people who either weren't vaccinated or had only the first set of vaccines. Alan Cheng, an infectious disease physician and epidemiologist at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, is eager to see whether the findings from the prison study are replicated in household studies, which might better reflect how the virus spreads the community. If replicated, the findings will probably apply to other emerging variants too, given that most are subvariants of Omicron, he says. And although the benefits of vaccination in reducing transmission fade over time, he welcomes the news that prior infection could reduce transmission in a future infection. Cheng says, particularly with Omicron, where we are having so much trouble trying to control it in general, we are happy with anything we can get.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country. In the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
This Friday prayer is a weekly event. When such a community exists where a large group of people in a city gather in a certain place every week, it can be a base, it can be a meeting place to discuss all the important issues of the society. When everyone is expected to gather together, people think of what things to say. Societies have needs. There is everything from intellectual issues to social services, from their people's cooperation to their military mobilization for defending the country. All of these are realized and carried out in this continuous weekly gathering. And these things come about. That is, they can come about. There is an opportunity of this importance and greatness in this gathering. Therefore, this is an enormous treasure and an extraordinary opportunity that has been given to us.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another feature of the Friday prayers is the combination of spirituality and politics. This is something that is rare for materialistic people and those who don't ponder over matters. How can politics, spirituality, and the belief in God exist in one place? Politics has a basis that in appearances is contradictory to the remembrance of Allah and the like. So mixing politics with spirituality in an obligatory act is a virtuosity that belongs to Islam. It's Islam's work of art. The following tradition has been narrated from Imam Ridha alayhi salam about the Friday prayer leader. He informs them of the prospects and fears that have come upon them, in which they will have both harm and benefit. This is an important, great matter. The events that are taking place in the world and that have a relationship with our society, either as a loss or a benefit, are expressed to the people by the Friday prayer leader. Let's consider the example of the issue of nuclear power, or the war in Ukraine. This is an issue that is happening in the world, or there are different matters relating to the politics of the East and the West. These are things that affect our country, our society, our life, and our politics. Well, the Friday prayer leader explains, describes, and talks about these things for the people with sufficient and correct information. He links politics with spirituality. He says, "Be pious towards God." People must be reminded to practice piety in the Friday prayer sermon. At the same time, he explains politics to people. This kind of politics, international politics. This is also one of the issues that is one of Friday prayer's features. It has other features too, of course, which I have spoken about briefly.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Former FBI official Peter Sturzak said in an interview on Sunday, 28th of August, that foreign intelligence services in countries including Russia have been absolutely interested in gaining access to former President Donald Trump's Florida property at Mar-a-Lago. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Xander Landon. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled, "Russia Absolutely Tried to Infiltrate Mar-a-Lago." Former FBI official. Former FBI official Peter Sturzak said in an interview on Sunday, 28th of August, that foreign intelligence services in countries, including Russia, have been absolutely interested in gaining access to former President Donald Trump's Florida property at Mar-a-Lago. Peter Sterzog's comments come after the FBI raided the property of Donald Trump earlier this month as part of an investigation into whether Trump potentially mishandled classified information that he took with him after he left the White House last year. A search warrant revealed that agents seized items, including top-secret documents, from the property on Monday, 8th of August. During his interview on MSNBC, host Katie Fang asked Peter Sterzog if he believes it's a possibility that the Russians would have been interested and possibly tried to infiltrate Mar-a-Lago to get classified information. Well, Katie, absolutely the Russians, but not just the Russians, any competent foreign intelligence service, whether that's those belonging to China, those belonging to Cuba, certainly including Russia, are all interested in gaining access to Mar-a-Lago, Peter Sterzog responded. Sterzog added, what's especially concerning right now is some of the information that's coming out about the absolute lack of any sort of control or memorialization of who had access to Mar-a-Lago at any given time, particularly in the context of the fact that it appears that classified documents were strewn all over the facility. Peter Sterzog was fired from the FBI after text messages from 2016 were released revealing anti-Trump remarks between himself and FBI lawyer Lisa Page. Sterzog has remained a critic of the former president and published a book in 2020 titled Compromise, Counterintelligence and the Threat of Donald J. Trump. During his interview, Peter Sterzog said that regardless of the knowledge that classified documents were there, foreign intelligence services are going to have been trying to gain access to Mar-a-Lago during and after Trump's presidential administration. And that's absolutely the sort of thing that the U.S. intelligence community, and the FBI in particular, are going to be concerned about, trying to establish who had access to the grounds, who had access to that storage area, and what they need to do to mitigate any sort of damage that might have occurred, he added. Newsweek has reached out to Donald Trump's press office for comment. In the wake of the search at Mar-a-Lago, some have speculated who may have provided the FBI with information about Donald Trump's possible mishandling of classified information. During an interview on Friday, veteran Republican political strategist Karl Rove said that Secret Service officials could have been the mole. The former president has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing and accused the FBI of corruption, although the federal agency is currently led by Director Christopher Wray, a Republican whom Donald Trump nominated to the position. The former president also said that the FBI search was part of a broader partisan witch hunt targeting him and his family. Meanwhile, Andrew Weissman, a former Department of Justice prosecutor, said on Friday that the former President Donald Trump will be prosecuted over the way he handled classified documents after the FBI search warrant affidavit was unsealed. Andrew Weissman's comments come after a redacted affidavit was unsealed by Judge Bruce Reinhardt last Friday, showing the way Donald Trump handled classified documents that were retrieved from his Florida Mar-a-Lago residence during an FBI raid earlier this month. When I read this today, my big overarching takeaway is, and I know this is just a prediction and a speculation, but I say it's an educated one, is that the former president is going to be prosecuted. I don't see how you cannot give in this information, he said during an interview on MSNBC's Deadline, White House.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Afghan women have been struggling for their rights under the Taliban rule. Recently, they have launched this cultural spot under the name of Women's Library.
There are more than 2,000 books in this library. Women and girls can borrow books or enjoy reading them here.
Meanwhile, the founders of the library say this place offers plenty more than just books.
Our aim for setting up this library is to provide teenage girls with a place to study, communicate, and receive an education. Our second goal is to provide a cultural spot for those women who have lost their jobs and have nothing to do. You know that today many Afghan women are literate and don't accept forced isolation at their homes.
Mitra Kakar, a student of 11th grade, was banned from attending her school when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in August last year. She visits such places to study books, practice drawing, and hang out with friends.
It has been almost a year since we were left out of school. When the Taliban came to power, we were told not to attend our classes. Since then, I have been going through tough times, but I never quit receiving my education. I got an English class and started learning drawings. I also love books and libraries like this. I just hope our school reopens and I can make it to the university. I want to study fine arts.
This place is also becoming a stage for women to speak out. One of the women rights activists here told us that the Afghan women are facing a rollback on their rights since the Taliban's return to power.
If we look through history, Afghanistan has had many prominent, creative, and leading women in different arenas. But since we live under the Taliban rule, it looks like this chain is unfortunately being broken, with women being sidelined or disappearing from active social life. We will keep raising our voices and defend our rights. Neither Islam nor Afghan culture has barred women from getting an education or going to work.
Afghan women rights activists also call on the global community to take serious and practical steps for women rights in Afghanistan. They say that merely condemnations can't relieve their pain, but the international community needs to come forward to press the Taliban to change their stance and uphold the rights of women and girls. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Rights groups have condemned the death of a 6-year-old Palestinian boy, Farouk Abu Naja, who died last week in Gaza after Israel denied him an exit permit to travel to Al-Quds for urgent medical care. 4 patients, including 3 children, have died so far this year because of the inhumane Israeli practice. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished territory can be a stressful and unpredictable process.
Israel is fully responsible for the death of the child according to the 4th Geneva Convention. This case is yet another example of Israel's continuous violation of international humanitarian law and human rights law. Denying access to necessary medical care for a child is unwarranted and grave.
We met with the family of Farouk Abu Naja in the southern Gaza Strip, town of Khan Yunis.
When Farouk was born, he was a healthy child, but at the age of 3, he started showing signs of sickness and weakness. His health started to deteriorate, and he was diagnosed with cerebral atrophy. Doctors in Gaza referred him to a hospital in Al-Quds. We applied for an Israeli permit twice, but we were told that his care is under security review. Israel killed my son. Farouk died Wednesday night while waiting for the permit.
Over 1,000 Palestinian patients have lost their lives in the Gaza Strip since 2007. The large number of deaths highlights the lethal impact of Israel's crippling blockade on nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the coastal enclave.
The crippling Israeli blockade and the arbitrary restriction have battered the health sector in Gaza. Hospitals suffer from acute shortage of essential drugs and medical devices and insufficient number of specialized health professionals. Local hospitals are unable to treat many serious diseases, and so raising the number of patients referred for treatment abroad.
Hospitals in the Gaza Strip lack many essential drugs they need to treat patients suffering from severe illnesses. under the current circumstances, the health condition of many patients is likely to further deteriorate.
The Israeli blockade has had a devastating impact on the health and the well-being of people in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Hundreds of Palestinian patients have already lost their lives in recent years in the besieged enclave due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Over 16 months of on-and-off discussions over the revival of the JCPOA appear to be nearing an end, with Tehran reviewing the U.S. response to its amendments on a recent EU draft proposal aimed at reviving the accord. The negotiations started after U.S. President Joe Biden took power on a pledge to correct the mistakes of his predecessor, Donald Trump. That's the man who unilaterally abandoned JCPOA in 2018 and launched a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. President Ebrahim Raisi has now reiterated Iran's conditions for an agreement. They include the settlement of safeguards issues between Iran and the UN nuclear agency.
What have been raised are first assuring guarantees. Second, the verification of the sanctions removal in an objective and practical manner. Third, the removal of sanctions in a meaningful and sustainable way. And fourth, an end to what I call political accusations regarding safeguard issues.
Raisi argued that it's pointless to restore the deal without putting an end to those safeguards accusations. He was referring to the IAEA recently asking Iran to provide explanations for what it called traces of enriched uranium at some of its undeclared sites. Tehran says these are baseless accusations coming from Israel. In his presser, Raisi was asked to comment on Israel's recent threats that it won't be bound by a JCPOA revival agreement and it will do everything to prevent Iran from attaining a nuclear capability. The president said the regime can never hinder Iran's nuclear progress.
The Zionist regime's threats against Iran have led to nowhere. The assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists was meant to stop Iran's progress in the nuclear field, but we were not stopped. Many acts of sabotage and seditions were aimed at stopping us, but we were not stopped. And no measure by the Zionist regime and the arrogant powers will stop Iran from its right to obtain nuclear energy.
Deal or no deal, Iran appears set to resolve its sanctions problems once and for all. Raisi says Tehran pursues efforts to nullify the sanctions concurrent with its efforts to get the sanctions removed. He cited a huge boost in Iran's exports since his government was formed last year, pointing to a five-fold increase in Iran's trade with regional countries.
The final act of terror by the U.S. before ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan was targeting a civilian car with a missile and killing 10 members of a family last year. 2-year-old Somaya was the youngest and 6 other victims were under 18. 3 adults were also among the fatalities. This deadly strike took place by the U.S. forces amid their evacuation following the Taliban's return to power.
We heard a very terrifying sound. We were running like crazy to get there. We saw a car burning in fire. People were killed. There was a lot of smoke and people were screaming. The U.S. said there was ISIS in that house, but later they confessed they were all civilians.
So, were there others killed? Yes.
U.S. officials tried so hard not to utter the word civilians at first, but later they confessed that the strike was a mere mistake, taking the lives of 10 innocent people.
And acknowledge our mistakes.
The last memory from U.S. presence in Afghanistan is the drone strike that killed 7 children. During their presence, the Americans conducted thousands of similar operations, killing countless civilians. They use this attack to turn the media away from their shameful pullout. They do such actions by breaking legal and international standards. This was a war crime, and the perpetrators should have been tried.
According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, more than 900 civilians have been killed in the U.S. airstrikes since 2015 in Afghanistan. And so far, no one has been held accountable. The drone strike that took the lives of 7 children and 3 adults showed once more that the victims of the U.S. missions are mostly innocent civilians. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul. Italy's energy crisis keeps getting more worrying by the day as wholesale gas prices have surged to skyrocketing levels. Italy, like most of its European neighbors, has reviewed its energy strategy following the start of the war in Ukraine and the sanctions against Russia, Rome's largest gas supplier, accounting for over 40% of imports. In an attempt to diversify its gas supplies, Rome has sealed new deals with Algeria and has planned the construction of new gas infrastructures, a move that includes buying more LNG and setting up new regasification plants.
Italy relies on fossil gas for 40% of its electricity production, with the consequence that electricity costs have gone crazy. Our industrial system relies very much on gas-produced electricity. The risk is that the products of our steelmakers and of our manufacturers will soon be out of the market.
Italy's industrial lobby Confindustria has warned of the risk of widespread company failures if energy prices keep surging this way. Confindustria is calling on the government to create a plan for rationing gas and to provide new subsidies to shield manufacturers. Gas prices have recently climbed to over 320 euros per megawatt hour, three times the price recorded at the beginning of July, and about 1,000% more compared to the same period a year ago. Businesses have slammed the rate as unsustainable, while consumer groups have described it as an emergency.
The impact on the average Italian will be dramatic. I expect a profound reshape of our lives and energy future.
In less than a month, Italy will return to the polls with a large number of electors expected to skip the vote. According to latest polls, 16 million Italians, accounting for 35% of Italy's 51 million voters, will not cast their ballot as, quote, the trust in politician is wearing thin. Max Civili, Rome.
On the outskirts of Srinagar, hundreds of people gathered to attend the annual Imam Hussein conference held each year during the holy month of Muharram. Shia as well as Sunni scholars came together to discuss the importance of unity in Islam, the relevance of the Battle of Karbala, and lessons from Imam Hussein to dwell upon.
Imam Hussein, an exemplary personality, needs no introduction. Organizing such conferences in the current world order helps Muslims understand what role they need to play. Imam Hussein set an example by sacrificing his life and that of his companions. He set an unmatched limit of being steadfast to the mission of Islam. These conferences are important as they help people revive their pledges.
Scholars speaking on the occasion emphasized the role of youth in spreading the teachings of Imam Hussein. The scholars warned people against plot by Islam's enemies.
The current world order is against Islam. It's against peace and justice. Evil plots are being hatched against Muslims to divide them. Muslims must remember one thing. Islam is one religion and we must have strong faith in Islam.
Participants at the conference concluded that the Battle of Karbala is a defining moment in the history of Islam that will continue to inspire people regardless of their religious belief.
According to the organizers of Yom Hussein or the Day of Hussein conference, such events are a reminder for Muslims to follow the path of truth, justice and equality in letter and spirit. And not to forget, the key to greater success of Islam is through unity between Shia and Sunni sects of Islam. Shahane Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The Saudi Lidwo in Yemen is still taking its toll on the nation even under the UN brokered truce. Yemen's Ministry of Health has held a press briefing in Sana'a to highlight the catastrophic repercussions of the Saudi aggression and the impact of the ongoing siege of Yemen.
We held this press conference to review the impact of the Saudi aggression since its beginning, as well as the aftermath of the siege amid the UN armistice, which unfortunately did not change anything. There are tragedies caused by the Saudi-led coalition throughout the years of war, as health facilities and workers have been targeted, and we explain to the world what is happening in our country under the eyes of the United Nations and with the support of the US, Britain and the rest of major powers.
The ministry's